Episode 3633 of the Survival Podcast. And since this is the promised Bitcoin show that was coming this week, it's also Bitcoin Breakout number 57. Yeah, 57 Bitcoin Breakouts since we launched that a couple years ago. So probably about one every 2 weeks. It doesn't feel that way, but when you do the math across time, that's what it is. There's times when they come in bursts and there's times when they go away for a month or so. It just is the way it is. I will let you know we will have another Bitcoin show not too far in the future. Stephen Lubka from Swan Bitcoin will be returning to the show for an interview. So that one's definitely going to be about Bitcoin. There's a lot of people in the comments saying, I bought today's drop, bought today's dip. And I'll just point out for a bit, it's pretty interesting to me to be talking about Bitcoin and buying the dip in the mid to upper $80,000 range. And that kind of fits in with what we're going to talk about today. Bitcoin being the best store of value or form of money that we have. And so what we're going to come at this today is arguments from both sides or statements that are made continuously by both sides of the Bitcoin world that sort of fall apart when we just change the word Bitcoin into money. Including, I'm going to lead off with a statement that I've made many times, and it's kind of why I'm doing this show, or this episode, I guess, because the show is the whole thing, and the episode is today only, in that I often say something like, never spend your Bitcoin. I don't really mean never. I've tried to clarify that before. What I really mean is spend it last. You have various forms of money that you hold your wealth in, and you should hold on the longest to the hardest forms. Which is a basic economic principle. But there's a lot of things that people say about Bitcoin that just sounds absolutely stupid when you just change the word to money. Like, no one should ever buy a Bitcoin ETF. No one should ever buy a Bitcoin or an ETF that holds currency then, right? No one should ever buy a dollar ETF as a form of hedge against another investment. Or nobody should buy an ETF that holds another form of currency like the pound or the euro. It's just dumb. Or only we shouldn't let government use Bitcoin and we shouldn't let government use money. Now, I'm all about not letting government steal money. That's taxation. But governments are going to steal money. And if governments were to hold Bitcoin, they might be better off. Again, this all comes down to just simply looking at Bitcoin and saying, well, what is it? And we can talk about it from a cryptography standpoint. We can talk about it from a blockchain standpoint. We can talk about it as analyzing what makes Bitcoin different as money. But if we just simply say, what is Bitcoin? And we want a one-word answer to it that requires no additional explanation, there's only one real word we can use for it, and that is money. If I say, what is gold, we can come up with a scientific analysis of gold about, you know, what atomic number it has and, you know, what makes it different from the elements one above and one below it. Or we can come up with why it's been used as money. But if you really want to say, what is gold, you really have two answers you can give, metal or money, right? And the real answer, like from a practical standpoint of how gold has been used historically and even now, is as money. So as soon as we get to that level with Bitcoin, as soon as we simplify to that point, everything gets easier, including the complex parts of it. Like, why should you spend your Bitcoin last if it's just money? Well, because it's money that's treated differently and has different attributes than what we think of as money as, let's say, the U.S. fiat dollar. That's why. We're going to talk about all that more today, and I'm hoping it will help many of you who have struggled with understanding Bitcoin to understand it better and struggle to understand why people like me that are referred to as toxic maxis really are the way we are. We're just trying to protect, especially new people, from making dumb mistakes with their money, which means if you have Bitcoin, Bitcoin is one of your forms of money that you store your wealth value in. With that, before we go ahead and get into it, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. And today's sponsor of the day, number one, may surprise you. Here I am doing a show about Bitcoin, and my lead sponsor today is a company that sells precious metals, JM Bullion. I actually don't think it's a bad fit at all. I have never been the kind of person that says, put all of your wealth into one form of money. I've always talked about actual diversification. And I've always explained to you when your financial advisor, I mean liar, says you're well diversified because you have growth in income stocks, right? And you have, you know, large cap and small cap stocks. And then you have a bond fund that you're not diversified at all because all you have are assets denominated in dollars leveraged into a common vehicle like an ETF or a mutual fund. That's all you have. You don't have any real diversity. That's one form of money. It's all paper. It's all diversified into the same thing mixed up. But then if we had precious metals, we had Bitcoin in self-custody, we have a traditional 401k or IRA that uses assets more like that, all of a sudden we start to have true diversity. We add some real estate to that mix, et cetera. But precious metals, I've made the same recommendation for years, 5% of your wealth in precious metals, just 5%. And as your wealth grows, your stack of precious metals grow. That's the way that that should work. I always said 5 to 10%, but that's because some people want to go harder. 10 is kind of my upward limit on precious metals. I'd much rather you put your money in Bitcoin, but gold and silver serve a purpose as well. If you're going to buy precious metals, JM Bullion is where to go. You're going to pay less than Monex, Apmex, Lear Capital. If there's a problem, I can contact the president and get the damn problem fixed, and I mean fast. Plus, they'll give you a discount if you're an MSB member. Plus, you'll get you get all your shipping done for free. So I don't know why you would use anybody else when JM's been so stellar for this community. Next up, once you build wealth, you might want to build even more wealth. Well, John Pugliano can help you with that at the Wealth Studying Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth the way you grow a garden in a repeatable fashion over and over again that just keeps making it better. John's also a huge fan of one of my favorite books of all time, George Clausen's classic, The Richest Man in Babylon. We're actually going to wrap this episode up with five quotes from Clausen's book, and we're going to change the word in the book that is gold, that meant money back then to people reading the book. We're going to change that word to Bitcoin. I think John would agree that it makes a lot of sense. But if you want to really understand how to build your wealth, check out the Wealth Studying Podcast at wealthstudying.com. John puts out about an episode a week of it. It's short, direct, and to the point. And John is one of us, guys. John is a prepper. He's a reloader. He's a gun enthusiast. He's a ham radio operator. Check him out today at wealthstudying.com. With that, let's go ahead and dig on into this. I want to talk to you today again from a standpoint of simply changing the word Bitcoin to the word money when certain arguments are made for or against it, both sides of that. I'll remind you as well that if you want to ask me a question while you're in the live stream, it won't do you any good if you're watching the replay. Though if you comment, I try to answer most comments if there's a question. But if you want me to do it on the fly here, you need to put the word question in all caps before you do it, just like Andrew did right there. I'm not going to read his question, but I am going to start it so that we will come back to it at the end. I am right now alone. I have nobody with me, and I have one eye that's useful anyway. So if you don't follow that, there's about a 99% chance I'm not going to see your question. All right, so let's start off. If we're going to talk about Bitcoin simply being money, we should probably start off talking about money. Just what is money? And there's a lot of ways we can answer that question. It's actually a very simple question with a lot of complex answers. So let's change it more to what are the various forms that money has taken over time? And we can think about the stones on the islands that never even moved. They just were cut with a hole in the middle, and the chief could go out and say, this belongs to this family now, or 10% is this person's, and 80% is this person's, and 10% more is this person's or this clan's, and try to tally sticks, someone saying, and they're not wrong. But in the end, a tally stick was probably a hybrid because it was probably a fiat plus a hard money behind it. So that might lead you to where we're going here. There's really four primary categories that money has taken in form over time. There is a barter form of money, which means that there was no real standardization, and it's why people had to come up with a more account-based, ledger-based form of money in the first place. Barter is the original value-for-value exchange. I'm in a hunter-gatherer clan, and we're moving along as nomads, and we primarily develop most of our food by hunting, and we have lots of dried meat. And we happen to meet your clan, which is more sedentary and space-based. And instead of fighting with each other, we do what humans generally do when they first encounter each other. We try to have commerce with each other. Commerce with each other is a great way to distribute resources without one side just dominating another. And so we show you a bag of dried meat, and you show us a sack of grain, and we kind of agree that this much meat is worth this much grain to us, and back and forth, and then we make a trade, and we go on about our way, and you have your meat, and we're all good to go. But what happens when that exchange attempts to happen, but you guys aren't just growing grain, right? You guys are actually hunters too, and you have plenty of meat and plenty of grain. We want grain, but you don't want meat. We have a problem. Well, that leads us to a different type of money, and that is a commodity money, also known as a hard money. A commodity money is limited in some way. It could actually be fabricated, or it could be something that is just naturally based. Gold would be a commodity money, and it's naturally limited. It takes energy to get it out of the earth. It takes energy to refine it into a pure form and make it into a size that's understandable to people. And so it's a commodity money, and it's hard because it's a commodity. Likewise, if my clan of hunters is really good at making flint knives and yours isn't, like, we are actually making that flint knife, and the flint may not be that valuable, or the glass, the volcanic glass won't come to me, but you guys know what I mean. Like, if we're making knives out of something like that, then we are going to, again, have a limitation, because we can only make some. First, we got to get appropriate material, and then it has to go through a process to be turned into a knife. Now we're back to barter, but we're also kind of bartering on a commodity. And commodity and barter are always kind of somewhat in exchange. If you think about it, what is the difference really in you selling me something for a little bit of gold or us trading something other than what the tax man says? It's not a lot. Both are really forms of hard money. Just different forms of hard money have different, because it's hard doesn't mean it's durable. So if we trade you meat, it can go bad eventually. If we trade you gold, it kind of lasts forever. So most true commodity monies have been really lasting, silver and gold. And I would say Bitcoin, by our own government's definition, is a commodity, and hence a commodity money. It's finitely limited, and that finite limit is enforced through computing power and the expense of expended energy. That's why Satoshi called it mining. Then we have fiat. Fiat money is what we call soft money. There's certain people I just don't have any, I don't have any patience for. I just don't. people that try to make arguments out of sayings, I don't have patience for. Anyway, fiat is soft money. Fiat simply means that the government dictates this as value. And there's actually not much fiat money that's pure fiat in the world, more along the lines of certain forms of hybridization. But it's the word as it's understood. The U.S. dollar is a fiat currency. It has value because the government says it does. The government puts a little line on the bill that says this is legal tender for all debts, private and public. But the one that people really give a shit about is you can pay your taxes in it, because if you don't pay your taxes, they take all your other stuff away, like your liberty, your freedom, and your property. So that is what gives it value more than anything else. What backs the U.S. dollar more than anything else are giant aircraft carriers floating around in the ocean with a lot of firepower. Nuclear missiles back the U.S. dollar. But it's only a currency because the government created it and decided to. There is no upward limit to how much of it they can create. The reason I say it's somewhat a hybrid, and somewhat is a good term, I think, is because there is technically a limit in that new money is created by lending, by debt. And there is a point where, like, everybody's like, well, we're not going to lend you any more money. So that puts a cap on the currency. There's some limitation there on that fiat. But of course, the Federal Reserve just issues its own debt and makes more money. So it's really accurate mostly to just describe most Western, most global currencies today. It don't matter if it's an Eastern currency or Western currency, the Russian currency, the Japanese currency, the euro, the pound, the dollar, the peso, et cetera, the rupee, the ruble, all of it. It's all fiat. It's all dictated by government. And then we have a true hybrid currency. This is currency where you have kind of a fiat soft currency with some anchor to a hard money. And this is not difficult to understand if you just back up a second and think about it. We had exactly this form of money from about 1933 until about 1971. We did not have a hard currency in that period of time, like people seem to think. It was a hybrid. If you go back prior to then, we had gold literally pegged to the dollar, and gold was the limiting, and it was 100% limiting, and it was not something that would be revalued because, oh, we don't like the way things are right now. And so a dollar was literally exchangeable for a fixed amount of silver, and a $20 bill was a fixed amount of gold, is the best way to think about it. So there was a hard money time in this country. There's a fiat money time, and in between there was a hybrid where we said, oh, yeah, we're just going to change the valuation. And gold is now, you know, $38 to the ounce versus $20 to the ounce. So right at that moment, we untethered from an actual peg to gold, and we created massive inflation overnight for people. And we took everybody's gold, and we said, we're going to put the gold away. And as we all know, we never had as much gold as we said we did, which is why it was a hybrid. There was a gold back, but there wasn't enough gold to cover the amount of printing. So it was partially hardbacked and partially fiat. And when France called our bluff on it, that's when Nixon ended up having to close the gold window in 71. But for all the shit Nixon gets over that, Nixon inherited that reality. By the time Nixon became president, that was already done. And people, a lot, especially boomers, right, that are gold bugs, say Nixon should have just stuck to it. Well, you have no idea what that would have done to the United States economy and the global economy at the time. You could say that now, but you don't get it. You don't get it. If we had admitted where we were at that time, if we had not untethered at that time, you would have collapsed the dollar in a way that it's very difficult to understand. And it would not have been the way the dollar is collapsing now and kind of this slow erosion over time. It would have been almost instantaneously, and it would have plunged the United States into something that would have made the Great Depression look like good times. Unfortunately, that may be our future. We will see. But those are your four types of money. So when we look at Bitcoin, we need to look at it's just money, but it's absolutely hard money. And when people say it isn't, I do not have time to even bother with those people anymore. All I can tell you is you haven't done the research necessary. When you say it's not backed by anything, what you're saying is having the most powerful and most secure computer network in the world is nothing. And I just don't have time for that, so I'm not going to bother with it today. But here's some dumb pro-Bitcoin arguments. In fact, there's five of them. And I'm leading off with the one I've said many times, and hopefully it will clear up what I really mean. Never spend your Bitcoin. Never spend your Bitcoin. How about this? Never spend your money. You'll be wealthier if you keep every dollar you ever earn. The statement on its face is true, except you're going to starve to death. You're not going to have a place to live. You're not going to have a car. You're not going to have air conditioning and heat if you do that. I guess if you can become some kind of hermit and still have some kind of an income, you could pull it off. But in the end, never spend your Bitcoin. Doesn't really work if you just change it. Never spend your money. But this will lead us to a better understanding of what people like me mean when we say never spend your Bitcoin. We really mean spend your Bitcoin absolutely last, because it's the hardest money that you can possess right now. So I've kind of flirted with explaining this, but I have a friend right now who's in his mid-30s. He has an opportunity to pick up a very nice, very large piece of land. He can do it with no money down on 2% interest. And the price is so stupid low because the person selling it to him wants him to have it, because he's not selling all his land. He's breaking a piece off, and he wants him as a neighbor. And he also has an option on a second larger piece in 5 years. And the interest rate on the already stupid low price is 2%. No money down. The problem is this person does not have enough capital to even build a small temporary homestead unless he sells pretty much all the Bitcoin he has. And it's not a lot. I don't want to say exactly how much, but it's not like he's going to go in there and throw up an 1,800 square foot home. It's going to be a very modest thing to get started with and move him and his family in. And he called me and we talked about this. And he said, I know you say never to do it, but, and he explained to me, I said, if I were you at your age, I would do what you need to do to get this done, because I'm not going to tell you this is the only great opportunity you're going to have, but I'm going to tell you, you're not going to get a better one than this. You're just not. Now, it's not like it's going to go away really fast or anything, but, and see, Huxley's asking, what about borrowing against Bitcoin to buy the land? I would not fucking do that in any loan that's available right now. And I broke out the F word to be abundantly fucking clear. Don't fucking do this. Okay? And I'm a little bit mad. I'm not mad at Huxley. Huxley is not who I'm mad at. I'm mad at people that keep fucking saying shit like that that should know better. Because this is the current Bitcoin loan you're going to get. Interest rate is 9 to 20 fucking percent. It varies by the goddamn hour. In fact, it varies inside the hour. It changes about every 9 minutes, and you have no control over it. Oh, pay it back whenever you get to it until you get called out and you lose everything. There is no way that I would recommend anybody go into that form of debt. I don't care what the collateral against it is. It's absolutely retarded. They're the shittiest loans that have ever existed, and they only exist for one reason. It's a reason we'll cover when we get to the George Clausen quotes about the richest man in Babylon. But I'll just give you the short version of it right now. It's so people can shitcoin in the shitcoin casino. So it's designed to be a short-term loan. A loan on land or constructed housing is by very definition not short-term. This person is also a variable income person, so they're not going to be able to go get a construction loan on the initial build anyway. Now, a few years into it, they may be able to do just that. So what they want to do is basically put in a shell that's more like a barn dominium shell, and just the upper part of it is where the housing will be. And they can do that fairly inexpensively, and they feel that it's worth it to get on the land. So that's an example. So I don't want to spend too much more time on this. I'm just saying there's one example where I'd say, yes, use your Bitcoin. Spend it, sell it, whatever. By the way, spending it and selling it are the same. They're the same net effect. The next dumb argument from pro-Bitcoiners is the exact opposite. It's the exact opposite. And that is, well, you have to spend your Bitcoin. We have to make it accepted. It has to be spent. If we don't spend it, we will fail. I just want you to imagine somebody saying, it's important that you spend more of your money. What would you tell them? What would you tell somebody who told you you need to spend more of your money? You're saving too much money. I think get fucked would be the thing that springs to mind first. Like, I don't believe, like, I'll give advice, but I'll never tell you you need to do something with your money. Like, that's not my business. I don't pay your bills. I don't work your job. I don't have your income. I don't have the same number of kids you have or don't have. I don't have your wife or your husband. I don't have the mortgage that you have. I don't have the job that you have. I'm not your age, most likely. A lot of you are younger than me. A lot of you are older than me. all of this changes how much money you spend, when you spend it, and what you allocate it to. You know when I'll spend my Bitcoin? About 10 years from now. I'll probably send, now, if we've evolved to the types of loans that Michael Saylor talks about with the amount that I have, I may very well use debt cycles to fund my retirement because that will make sense. But if they don't exist, there is a point where you like add up how much money you have, divide the number of years left, and say, if I take this much out, there's no way I'll outlive my money. And then you allocate from different buckets of money. And we'll get into that later because, again, when it comes to pulling money out of things, the ones with the most future value are the ones I want to pull last, right? But in the end, I'm not telling somebody you need to spend Bitcoin. I think spending Bitcoin, unless it's something like we just talked about in the first bullet, is stupid. Because you're doing something just because somebody said it or because of some obligation, some moral bullshit, fake-ass obligation, like Bitcoin needs you to spend it. Bluntly, money's used because it's useful. It doesn't need to be spent to be useful. It has to be a medium of exchange. No, it doesn't, and it is anyway. All it has to be is a good store of value, and people will naturally spend it when it makes sense, like when you have the opportunity to buy 16 acres for 20% of its actual value on a 2% note and you don't have another way to do it. You'll probably spend Bitcoin if that's you. Right, but we're not going to be out spending it just to spend it. Now, I agree, Bitcoin, and I don't want to spend my Bitcoin. Well, I just take dollars and take the address. Do you want it Lightning or do you want it on chain, John? I want it on chain. Boom, there you go. I've spent dollars. He gets Bitcoin. Effectively, I bought Bitcoin in the transaction, but now I don't have any freaking tax consequences. And some of what I'm saying, if government treated Bitcoin like what it is, money, instead of just a commodity, instead of commodity money, then I would feel a little different about that. The buy it and replace it strategy, sure, maybe I can even develop a schedule for that so I'm consistently refunding my spent stack on the dip, but that's not how it works. When I spend that Bitcoin, now I've got another freaking transaction to factor into my complicated taxes already. It just doesn't make any sense. So I don't think spending Bitcoin just day-to-day makes a lot of sense. Now, small amounts that no one gives a shit about, like Lightning exchanges on podcasts and Nostr and all, go nuts with it. No one cares. No one's ever going to care. They're never going to track that shit down. It's not worth worrying about, okay? But when we're talking about, you know, when you're buying stuff, especially consumer-grade stuff, you're going to take hard money and buy something you're going to eat and shit out the next day. That doesn't make sense to me, but I'm not going to go never spend it. We've covered that already. But Bitcoin doesn't need you to spend it to be successful. And anybody saying that is just somebody hungry to talk about something because honest to God, most of the time there's not that much to talk about. Yeah. Next on, hold at all costs and never sell. Right? It's really just a repeat of the never spend your Bitcoin argument. Hold at all costs. So let's say that I have a stack of Bitcoin. I've got, we'll say, $500,000. And I have a house, and that house is a $200,000 house. That's what I owe on the house. I'm not spending my Bitcoin to pay the house off, especially if I have an interest rate like I do. I have an interest rate of 2.98% or something like that. It's under 3. There's no way I would do that. But let's say you lost your job. And you needed to sell Bitcoin to make 2 or 3 house payments so you don't go into foreclosure until you get another job. Well, I wouldn't hold at all costs then because the cost of losing your house and destroying your credit while you're sitting on $500,000 of money is dumb. But I wouldn't in that state go out and dump $200,000 in one lump sum and pay the house off and say, now I'm good because I can go out and get another job. If I was injured and I was going to be on disability eventually, but that was going to take a while, and it would never be enough to service the mortgage anyway, now I might actually pay the house off, especially if I'm sitting there with, after I do that, I still got $300,000 worth of Bitcoin. That's a different scenario than when I sell my Bitcoin, I have 0. All of these things, it's just about money management in the end, and then being willing not only to make good decisions on spending and saving, but also to be able to look at your buckets of money and define them as what they are. Are they fiat or are they hard? And I would always spend the fiat before the hard, because one, the fiat doesn't come with a tax consequence, and two, the hard will be worth more in the future and the fiat will be worth less. It's a very simple thing when we break it down that way. Then we have Bitcoiners. Bitcoin is going to replace all fiat really quick. No, it's not. It hasn't. It's been 15 years. We've honestly not made a fucking dent in it yet, have we? We are one of the largest market cap assets on the planet now. We keep dicking around with silver. One day we have a higher market. One day we have a lower market cap. But in the end, Bitcoin and silver are equivalent market caps right now. It's a way to look at it. Because next week, Bitcoin might still be a little lower. And then the week after, Bitcoin might be higher, and significantly so. There's only a handful of market caps of anything left in the world that are higher than Bitcoin. Real estate, gold, and a couple companies. It's like the seventh highest market cap asset on the planet right now. It's still not a dent in fiat currency. A $2 trillion market cap, when the United States has over almost $35 trillion in debt, and you're talking about the whole world, not just the United States, it's pissant as a whole. But the big thing to take away from that is, if we call it money, no form of money has ever replaced another instantly or even rapidly. It took time for what most people agree to be the best money we ever had before the computer age, gold, to replace other forms of money. It took time to propagate throughout the world in a way that made sense. There were a lot of people at the time that gold first started being used by civilizations that weren't civilizations. They were hunter-gatherers. They couldn't give a toss. Even up until the time of the initial exploration and exploitation of North and South America by Europeans, many of the tribes in North and South America couldn't give a toss about gold. They thought that these European settlers were idiots. Like, you guys are this obsessed over gold? There were places that had so much gold but valued it so little, they literally like had the sides of buildings covered in it because it looked cool. They made all kinds of deals. You think that it was all stolen from them, but they were like, a lot of the shit you had was, we can always get some more gold. That's the way they looked at it. It takes time for any form of monetization to overcome another form of monetization. It's not going to happen rapidly. We're not going to have hyper Bitcoinization overnight. Another one is, Bitcoin is the only way to be free from a financial standpoint, right? It's the only way. Michael Saylor says there is no second best. He doesn't mean it that way, but people then take that literally. Like, it's the only freedom money there is. All FU money is freedom money. There isn't a single one of you out there that if I said, I'll give you $10 million right now, you can do anything you want with it, but the only thing you can't do with it is buy Bitcoin. Say, Jack, I don't want your money. Not one of you. Not a single damn one of you. Any one of you out there would know at that point, I can go basically fund my entire life for the rest of my life out of that fiat, and I can buy all the fucking Bitcoin I want with other income and other money. You know that. So that means right there, the U.S. dollar can buy you freedom just like Bitcoin can. It's just not as good at it, because you're not going to get a check from me for $10 million. But there is a way to obtain freedom using fiat. Many people have. Using real estate, many people have. Using gold, less people recently, but traditionally it's been the number one way. Silver, and also just businesses as a whole that generate income. Farms that generate enough income to pay for the land. One of the richest people in society over, you know, the last couple hundred years ended up being Ray Kroc, the McDonald's guy. He developed a system and then used hamburgers to buy real estate. There was no gold or Bitcoin involved other than the dollar was still partially backed by gold while he was doing it all. So this idea that you have to have Bitcoin to have freedom is dumb. And no matter how much we love Bitcoin and how much we want to promote Bitcoin, when we talk that way, we sound stupid. And I'll tell you who we sound stupid to. The people that already have enough wealth to have freedom. They already have enough money to have freedom. If we present Bitcoin as an alternate form of money to those people that lets you do more of what you've already done, then they listen to us. If we present Bitcoin to them as the only way, then they think we're stupid because they've proven that their way works for them. Let's move to the other side of this, though. Dumb arguments from anti-Bitcoiners that die when we call it money. How about it's too volatile? Oh, there's my screenshot I want to bring up. How about this? The screenshot you're looking at, if you're in the live stream right now, and I'll describe it for those who are in the audio. This is a crypto, Tether, USDT. So while it moves a little bit, 99, 98 cents a dollar one, it's basically level with the dollar. But what I did is I pulled up on CoinStats, Tether priced in Bitcoin. And Tether launched in 2015, and you can see it had some volatility at the time. But if you look from when Tether launched in February of 2015 to date, there's been one direction the dollar's gone against Bitcoin. That looks like volatility to me, right up until it's basically zero. But if we were to shorten it, you would see variability and continuous downtrend. And so what people generally like to do with this is instead of showing you what I just did, they show you the value of the dollar over time and what it would buy for you, right? So they show you that, you know, it's lost 99% of its purchasing power since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. The reality, though, is even as bad as that graph looks, if you look at it from 71 to today, that's where the majority of erosion of value actually came. The inflation, as long as we even said had some semblance of some peg to a commodity like gold, it did keep inflation somewhat manageable for people, but it went to shit the minute we let go of it all. So if Bitcoin is volatile, when over time it constantly goes up against the dollar and constantly buys more and is worth more, what is the dollar then? It's psychologically stable. Because when we say we have a planned inflation of 2%, that's something that's manageable for people. They can adjust to it over time. But then you realize, like, does anybody here actually believe, and I'm not even talking about Brandon's 4 years, I'm talking about, let's say, the last 20 years, that inflation really is about 2 to 2.5%. You know, there was times during the Trump administration and during the Obama administration, both, where people like Janet Yellen lamented that inflation was too low because it was only 1.5 points. Like, that was a problem. Does anybody even believe that when it didn't seem that bad? I don't believe that at all. I'm going to tell you that inflation is more in the neighborhood, depending on what time you're talking, like best case scenario, about 4 and as high as 20 when we look at the actual cost of holding capital that's not making a return. It is. So to me, that's volatile. It's just that it's predictably volatile in one direction over time, which is down. So you can either have volatility as one asset consumes another in a continuous upward trend, or you can have volatility very stably over time down. You pick your volatility, but don't call one volatile and the other stable. It's just nonsense. It's just because everything around you is priced in dollars. That's the only reason you don't understand how volatile the dollar is. Go look at the dollar's volatility against hard goods, and you'll see exactly what I mean. How about this? Bitcoin is used for crime. You know what you just said? Money is used for crime. I mean, this anti-Bitcoin thing, well, they use it for crime. The number one currency used for crime in the world is the United States $100 bill, period. That's it, right? $100 bill is the number one unit of exchange by criminal enterprises in the world. The next number one thing used by criminal enterprises in the world is the U.S. dollar in electronic form through bank transactions in the legitimate system. Both of those will take the amount of Bitcoin used in criminal activity and make it look like the mouse fart that it is. It's not even a mouse fart. It's more like an ant fart, if ants fart. It's irrelevant to the total amount of crime. You want to see criminal activity? Look at what we just learned was being done with the U.S. dollar by the U.S. government through USAID. Don't give me this shit. Money is used as a criminal's tool because money is used by everybody. That's why. Criminal uses money because everybody uses money. Criminals use money because it's how you store the value of a transaction when you're not ready to buy the other thing just yet. I'm saving up for a car, so I save dollars to buy a car. If I'm working a job, I do that. If I'm selling cocaine, I do that. If I'm an illegal weapons dealer, I do the same. We all do the same thing because money is money. All right. Next up is, well, governments can ban it. So what good is it? Governments have banned gold. Did it go away? Governments have banned cash. Did it go away? Governments ban all kinds of shit. Cocaine is banned. Is it really that hard to get cocaine? Crack is banned, form of cocaine. Is it really that hard to get crack? In a lot of places, it's still illegal to sell cannabis. There's plenty of it. If something has value, it won't go away just because government says it has to go away. I mean, it's like government trying to ban gravity. Government can totally pass a law that says man will not be affected by gravity. Go jump off a fucking bridge and see if it worked. It's a nonsensical statement. In fact, Bitcoin is impossible to actually ban the possession and exchange thereof because it runs on software. So as long as it runs anywhere, it runs everywhere that people desire for it to run. If you can't stop drugs from being sold in a prison, then how are you going to stop electronic bits from circulating around a connected globe? It's just a dumb argument. But that is the technical argument. Government can ban money. I'm back to good luck with that. Go ahead. Go for it. How about it's not backed by anything? Well, as we already discussed, what Bitcoin is backed by the security and validation of the most powerful computer network in the world that is totally anarchist and voluntary. Anybody can participate in it or choose not to participate in it, and yet it works, which means there's an actual desire for it. So it's not something that's unbacked. But you want to tell me it's not backed by anything? What is the United States dollar backed by? Debt on debt. When you start actually picking apart monetary creation, you realize how absurd it is. So we issue debt, and the debt is monetized by the further issuance of debt, which is then monetized through the issuance of currency. If that sounded stupid, it's because it is, but it's also true. It's also true. The United States dollar is not backed by nothing. Again, it's backed by men with guns. It's backed by security. It's backed by our willingness to enforce its validity. And it's backed by our government's ability to tax future generations. The number one thing that backs any nation's currency is the government's power to tax its own citizens in the future. That's it. Your birth certificate is the backing of the dollar. Your grandchild's birth certificate is the backing of the dollar. Now, these people that tell you can look up the value of your birth certificate are fucking nuts, and they're stupid, and you shouldn't listen to them. But in a sense, they're right. It is like we project our population to be this big by this time, and we can tax them this much before they kill us, and therefore we can borrow this much money factoring in inflation so we can borrow more because we'll devalue it over time. That's how the whole system works. So as soon as you just realize Bitcoin's another form of money, the backing is just different. You can either have money that's backed by the fact that it's immutable and borderless, frictionless, can move anywhere in the world in 10-minute blocks, can't be stopped, can't be censored, and it's incredibly secure because the amount of power used to secure it is more than the amount of power used to secure any other network in the world. Or you can choose a money that is backed by your government's willingness to blow people up and to tax future generations. So they're both backed. Just which backing do you prefer? Which one seems like it's going to work better? Next, it's too slow. Bitcoin's too slow. You know who says that? Well, first of all, shitcoiners do. But it's not even worth talking about shitcoiners anymore. I mean, what's happening in the shitcoin world is so bad. It's so awful. It's so showing itself that that's just a response of have fun staying poor, HFSP. But the person that says it and kind of means it and doesn't really know what they're saying is the person that thinks this way. Well, I went to Target or Albertsons or wherever, and I bought some shit. And then I went to the cash register, and I stuck my credit card in the thing, and it went beep approved, and I left with my shit. And they think the transaction just happened and was settled. That transaction did not happen. It wasn't settled. There was a ledger adjustment that said another party owed that merchant this amount of money, and generally final settlement is with about 72 hours after that happens, depending on when it happens. If it happens on a Sunday, it might be more like another day before that settlement actually goes through. So is 3 days fast? No, it's not. Or have you ever tried to wire money to, let's say, another country on a Sunday afternoon? How fast is that? How fast can you get money to your cousin in Spain with Bitcoin? 10 minutes. That's the answer. It's 10 minutes. Sometimes the blockchain may back up, may take 30, but in general, it's 10 minutes. How long will it take you to Western Union money? How long will it take one company to send money to another company in another country with an international bank wire transfer? Bitcoin is faster than anything that you can actually compare it to. And it has the liquidity on the other end 24/7 around the world. There is no place that you cannot use Bitcoin and convert it into something else. Pretty much 20 on New Year's Day, on New Year's Eve, on Christmas Day, on Easter Sunday. It trades all the time. Most of the other things we use do not trade, only other than business hours. So it's not slow. It's too expensive for small transactions. Yeah, go buy a $1.50 pack of gum with a credit card, and you're probably going to be told by the merchant to go screw yourself. And the reason is there's probably like a 90-cent minimum charge on that credit card transaction. That's why when you go into places, you'll see cash only for purchases under $5. Don't be surprised to continuously see that number go up either, because there's a fee to use the credit card. Just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not there, and it also doesn't mean that you don't pay it. Well, I don't pay the fee. I don't care. Yes, you do. You don't think merchants factor fees into the price of the products and services they sell? You're out of your mind. You don't think that I factor my fees from Strike or PayPal into the price of something like my MSB? You don't think I take those fees and deduct them from my profit when I file my taxes and make my quarterly prepayments to the government? You don't think those fees matter? If I was hiring people, you don't think those fees factor into how much profit I make and therefore how much I can pay my employees? It's a ridiculous argument. And we're back to that really does come from shit coiners. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard, but what if you want to buy a coffee and a scone? I've never met a single fucking person in my life. It's like, you know, man, I was trying to buy a coffee and a scone yesterday with Bitcoin, but I just couldn't get it done. On top of all that, Lightning fixes this. I just saw one of my good friends and a person I respect, you know, but he is a shit coiner, post a thing on X last week about how only 70% of Lightning transactions over $100 go through effectively. There's so much disinformation in that. And this person's not doing disinformation. He just believes what he believes, so he'll grab on anything that reinforces it. First of all, if you're doing a Lightning transaction and you're running your own node, then liquidity is your problem. And if you don't have the right balance of liquidity on your node, it won't work. Okay. That's number one. Number two, sometimes you run a Lightning transaction and it doesn't go through. Your money's not gone. You didn't lose it. It's not missing. And usually just doing it a second time, it goes through. So what's the big deal if I say pay and it goes failed, pay and it goes through? Has anybody here ever gone to the store and swiped a credit card and something went wrong and the transaction didn't go through and you knew there was money on the card, you knew the card was good, so you re-swiped it and it went through? That's all this person's talking about. He doesn't know it, but that's what he's actually talking about mostly. But the other side of it is small transactions. Why did the person that wrote the article he was referencing choose $100? Because not many people use Lightning for transactions that are that much in the first place. And a lot of transactions that you see on the Lightning Network are when people first start doing their own node management and they're figuring it out. So some of your errors come there. But the reality is, for what Lightning was intended to do, which is make small scale transactions and value for value exchanges work, it works flawlessly in reality against the total. I bet you that I process inbound hundreds of transactions a month, hundreds of Lightning transactions a month. If I include things like Fountain and people streaming me sats, it's thousands. And I still process a couple dozen that are like in the $50 range for MSB every month. And it all works. Just because you don't know how to use your own technology you put in place doesn't mean the technology's flawed. How many emails fail to send? It's just dumb. But it's definitely not slow, and it's not expensive. Neither one of those things are true at all. How about it's too complicated? Bitcoin's too complicated. That's saying that, like, knowing how much Bitcoin you have, seeing a price, saying, I want to buy that thing, scanning a QR code and hitting send is too complicated. It's only complicated because people that don't want to understand it don't want to understand it, and they say it's complicated, convince themselves it is, and they make what's not complicated complicated. You know what else is complicated? If you're an old-ass boomer and you haven't gotten on board with it, online banking is complicated. If you're my age, your grandmother would have just been terrified of online banking. How the hell is this Picasso computer? Little pop culture reference there. Know how much money I have. Well, grandma, it doesn't. You just logged in your own bank account. Well, if I can do it, other people can see it. You're correct. The bank you keep your money with can see your account. That's how it works. That's how it works. And if somebody gets your access, it's not complicated. People adapt. How about it's too new to trust? It's too new. It's 15 years old. It's actually older than that, but I'll go with 15 for the sake of this discussion. The U.S. dollar was a new currency at one time. Every currency that ever came into existence, every form of money that ever came into existence was new at one time. This money is too new of a form of money. Doesn't make any sense. Like I said, all we got to do is replace the word Bitcoin with money. How about it's not legal tender, so that's not real money. Can you buy stuff with it? Yeah. This legal tender you speak of, can I take this form of money and exchange it for that form of money? Yeah. Is it fungible in that regard, that whatever the value is at the time, every Satoshi is worth the same amount of U.S. dollars? Yeah. What the hell are you talking about? Money is not money if it's not legal tender. We're back to laws of man versus laws of nature once again, aren't we, friends? Gold isn't legal tender. Are you going to say it's not money? Many forms of money around the world are legal tender in one country but not another. Does that make them not money? Does the U.S. get to say what money is? Only the United States government can dictate that something is money. China can't call their currency money. Oh, you can, but only in China. So if I was going to give you $1 million worth of Chinese currency, you wouldn't want it because it's not U.S. legal. See how dumb that is? That is absolutely ridiculous. How about it's just a Ponzi scheme? It's a Ponzi scheme. Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme. How? How? Well, you have to have another no. How is it a Ponzi scheme? See, Ponzi schemes keep bringing outside money in and create the illusion that the person here has more than is in the total. Bitcoin, by its very nature, is auditable. We know exactly how many sats they are and exactly which addresses they sit on. And there will only ever be 21 million of them, and nobody ever promised you there'd be more. In fact, the promise that was made is there never will be more. Bitcoin is a unit of account. It's finite in quantity. And one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. 10 sats are 10 sats. It just stays that way. Now, how much utility it has is based on how many people want to hold it, and how many people will accept it, and how many people want to use it. That's true of all money. That's true of all money. In other words, it's like, It's only valuable because people believe in it. Well, that's how the dollar works. They're about to audit Fort Knox. Now, I'm going to tell you what I think is going to happen when they audit Fort Knox. Most or all of the gold that's supposed to be in Fort Knox is probably sitting there because why wouldn't it be? Because why wouldn't it be? Now, it may be that the number's lower by a little bit or something. It won't really matter. Here's why. If you took all the gold that they claim is in Fort Knox, all of it, and said, we're going to use that to pay off the debt, anybody that can do basic mathematics would laugh at you really, really hard. You know, I mean, like cartoon level laughter. Okay. The amount of gold that's supposed to be in Fort Knox, if it's all there, would not service the interest on our debt for 6 months. Think about that. If we took every piece of gold the U.S. is holding in reserve at Fort Knox, it wouldn't cover the interest on the debt for 6 months. But what if, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, what do you think would happen if Elon Musk and the Doge team get led down into Fort Knox and there is no gold? Or there's only like 5% of the gold that they claimed. And they're looking around trying to find it and they just can't. And the government's like, oh, no, it was here yesterday, right? What do you think would happen to the U.S. dollar? And it would have no meaningful monetary impact on the current ledger system that the Federal Reserve is. The Federal Reserve is a ledger-based system. That's all that it is, okay? It would have no meaningful impact because it right now doesn't have a meaningful impact. So if it's there or not, mathematically doesn't matter. But what would it do to people? It would destroy their confidence. How many people out there still think the dollar's backed by gold in some way, shape, or form and would immediately go, they lied? Oh, no. How many boomers still think the dollar's backed by gold? It's insane. It's absolutely nuts that people believe this. So that means in of itself, if you lose confidence in the dollar destroys itself. That's the true of all money. The minute people do not agree to use something as money anymore, it destroys the currency and its value. It's always a psychological thing. Now, there might be real mathematical issues that cause the loss in faith. But when a currency blows up overnight, the thing that was wrong was already there, and yet it still worked as long as people believed it. It's like magic. That's how they control you. They make money like magic. How about this one? I don't own any Bitcoin, and I never will because I missed my opportunity. I missed the boat. All I hear you saying when I just think of Bitcoin as money, as a form of money, is, well, I missed the opportunity to save money when I was young, so I'm not going to do it now. What would you tell somebody who's like 55 years old and they go, you know, I should have been saving for my retirement my whole life. But honestly, at this point in my life, I really don't have anything. I rent. I don't have a house. I have a car with a payment on it. I got like $1,000 in the bank on any given day. That's about as much as I have. My bills are pretty much equal to my income. And so since I didn't save money when I was 25 like I should have, I'm not going to do it now. You'd say, this person is so effing stupid. I want to get away from them before I catch stupid from them like a disease. Like my IQ is beginning to actually fall listening to words come out of this person's mouth. That's what you sound like to anybody informed as to what Bitcoin is when you say, I missed the boat. What you're saying is, I can't get rich quick. Do you think we got rich quick? Do you think anybody in the Bitcoin space really got rich quick? Now, if you go back to like pre-pizza day and you had the foresight to buy, you know, 50,000 Bitcoin when you could have got it for like a quarter of Bitcoin and you could scrape the money together and do it, then when we had the first big run-ups to like $100, it looked like you got rich overnight. Even that person could get rich overnight. Most people in the Bitcoin space that have even, let's say, $100,000 or more in Bitcoin, ground it out to get it. The people that have been around a long time that you think that they have a lot of Bitcoin, because they've been around a long time, they mostly spent that early Bitcoin. When they bought it for $30 and it went to 300, that's a hell of a return, isn't it? You can understand why somebody would cash their chips in at that point. And at $300, Bitcoin was still a risky asset. There was a lot of unknowns that were to come yet. So most people that are sitting on 100 grand to a million or more in Bitcoin, they had to grind it or they converted other wealth into it. And then they did well over time. it took time to get where they're at. I didn't become rich overnight because Bitcoin went up big time. I've done well with Bitcoin because even though I spent a lot, I mean, if I just didn't spend half of what I spent, I would probably be on every morning when I come on the show if I was still doing five a week, because I might be down to two a week if I had that kind of money. Hi, welcome to another episode of the Survival Podcast, coming to you live from Jackistan. That's what you would be hearing. That's how much wealth I don't have, because when it was early on, I was like, we need to spend it to make it work. This is the conservative aspect and the willing to grind and accept this right now. If you want to become a Bitcoiner, because you're not one yet, or you've even been farting around with a little bit of it and you got like $100 and you're sitting there refreshing the price on a daily basis like a moron, stop it. This is the truth about Bitcoin. It is the best way to get wealthy that there is right now through saving your earnings, but it's all pain. It's all pain. Until you ride through 4 years minimum, that's one cycle. If you can go through one cycle, come out the other end and stick to your principles, it gets really easy. Because the truth is, it's very simple. And this is why so many people, fail as Bitcoin commentators, because it's too simple. When I tell you on a regular show where Bitcoin comes off as an aside and I just say, take your reserve capital, put it in Bitcoin and don't spend it, there's the formula for wealth. It's going to hurt. Every dollar you put into it, you don't have. Every dollar you put into it, you're going to be tempted to go get it when it's worth two. And every time you do it, you're going to devalue your own future. That's reality, but it's going to hurt. Right now, Bitcoin's in the 80s. I don't know where at exactly. I'll pull it up so I'm not pulling numbers out of my ass real quick here. But, you know, it was 80-something thousand not long ago, so I'm pretty sure it's still in that range. It is. Oh, it's on the way back up. Yoo-hoo! It's up 0.15% last hour, $87,000. There's a very good chance that over the next 30 days, Bitcoin is going to be $107,000. And there's just as good a chance it's going to be 67,000. That's all pain for the person that hasn't already accepted that it's pain and been through it. Think of it like a workout, right? When somebody's working out, when you see somebody that works out every day, they make it look easy, don't they? Do you think their first workout was easy? Do you think when they were 40 pounds overweight, hadn't worked out in months, that it was easy? Do you think along the way, even as people were going, man, you look good, you're doing, keep it up, you don't think there were days they're like, fuck this, I don't want to do it today. But they stuck with it and did it because it was simple but not easy. That's how Bitcoin works. There is no easy way to earn and save wealth. There's just better ways than others. If you're trying to save your way to wealth with the dollar, you're going to lose. The system is designed for you to lose. The system is an antlion trap. Every time you stack value with dollars, the system erodes the value from underneath. This is why we all have 401ks and IRAs and shit like that. They've literally forced you to invest. That I don't consider buying Bitcoin and holding Bitcoin investing, because it's not like buying Apple stock. When Apple does good, you do good. When Apple does bad, you do bad. Right? It's not buying a piece of a company. It's a form of money. It's savings. It's just better savings. It's saving in a deflationary asset. And technically, Bitcoin isn't deflationary, right? Technically, Bitcoin's not deflationary because it is mildly inflationary. But since it's such a small quantity of total availability, the net effect is deflation. Meaning if there's an issuance that's 1% of the supply, but the demand for the supply in that same year is 10% of the supply, it's deflationary by 9%. It's basic math. And the numbers are better than that, which is why it performs better than that. Right now, there are single entities buying more Bitcoin per year than how much Bitcoin is produced per year. That's reality. That's what ETFs did. That's why this time may be different, even though it's the same but different, man. Okay, and I missed one, and that is that Bitcoin is deflationary, so no one will spend it. We have created a fear of deflation in society that is stupid. First of all, you know what's deflationary? All technology. What does an 80-inch TV cost today that's a couple inches thick or less with resolution that you couldn't have dreamed of in 1985? You can buy that for about $1,000. What was a 25-inch square shitty giant console TV in 1985? $1,000 or more. And $1,000 was more money than it is today because of inflation. Technology is inherently deflationary. The computer that I do all my editing and shit on that's over here, because I do all of this stuff I do on a Mac, and I do all of the editing and some other things like PowerPoint tools and stuff like that. I'll run that on PC, mainly because I'm familiar. I do all my accounting on PC because I'm familiar with Excel very well, and there's differences with like pages and things like that, right? But the computer I have over here, first of all, 10 years ago, you couldn't even buy a computer with the power it has. But if you bought the closest thing to it, it costs five times as much. So we have deflation throughout the technology space, and all it does is make things better for everybody. But we have convinced people that it's important that the value of their money go down, right? That's what we, when you say we need inflation to spur spending, you're saying it's important for the value of your money to go down. And if your value of your money goes up, you won't spend it. You may spend less of it, but there was a time when all we had was hard money for a long time in this country. People spent it because it was the only form of money they had. Now people were more, they were more dedicated to savings, but is that bad? Would it be bad if the average person really did save 10% of their income consistently? Wouldn't we have a better, more stable country? They're still going to spend the other 90%. Well, what if they, oh my God, save 20%? They're still going to spend the other 80%. And eventually, no matter how much money you save, it will be spent. You're going to hit retirement. You're going to start living off it. Or you're going to die and your kids are going to cry for about 5 minutes and they're going to go out and spend your money. That's just how it works. Jesse says a new truck costs $60,000. He's right. He's absolutely right. The cost of a truck went up, but the technology cost inside the truck went down at the same time. And a lot of things that vehicles can do today, they could never do. But let's drive this home with five quick quotes. Now, one of my favorite books of all time is The Richest Man in Babylon by George C. Clausen. And in that book, now he wrote this book at a time when people were really starting to shit their pants about their future. All kinds of turmoil was going on. But he wrote this book because he knew that people were concerned about money and wealth, and he thought it would sell, and he was right. It became one of the all-time bestsellers. And in it, he spun a narrative based on Babylon. It starts out with a conversation between like a builder and a chariot maker, you know. There were slaves that got their freedom and all. But the term he used more than money in the book was gold. But gold was just a representation of money. And when you read that book in, let's say, 1995, every time you saw the word gold in your head, you should just say dollars. Well, if you read that book in 2025, every time you see the word gold, you should say Bitcoin. Because now we have a better form of money. So if we do that, here's some of the quotes from George Clausen's book. Bitcoin labors diligently and multiplies for those who find it profitable employment. In other words, once you have wealth, do something with it, right? People that build businesses increase their net worth over time if they're smart about how they do it. That would be basically profitable employment for your money. How about Bitcoin slips away from those who invest it in businesses or purposes with which they are not familiar? Now, in the book, these are things like, I met this guy, and he told me he could get some gems, and that if I gave him the money when he traveled next time, he would bring back the gems, and we would split the profit. So, of course, the guy comes back and goes, here's your share of the gems, and hauls ass. And the dude that made the investment takes the gems to a jeweler, and the guy goes, these are worth dog shit. I don't even want them. And the splitting was He took a small piece of the money, the guy that ran the scam, bought a bunch of these shitty jewels so at least he could come back and hand them to him. And then if the guy says, well, hey, we got ripped off, he'd say, yeah, I know, I got ripped off too, man. I'm sorry. I thought, right. You like, if you want to know about jewelry, you talk to a experienced jeweler, not some guy that's going to where the jewels are cheaper. Same, like it's a chariot race scenario where they knew this one horse was going to win, but of course they don't know anything about that. If you're going to take the advice of someone who builds houses, take the advice, their advice on carpentry and maybe even investing in a construction company, but don't take their advice on racehorses unless they're also an expert on racehorses, and they're probably not. Okay. Bitcoin clings to the protection of the cautious owner who invests it under the advice of wise men. Same thing. If you are going to do something with your money, with Bitcoin just being a form of that money, it should be under the advisement of people who have proven themselves skilled and a YouTube video that makes it look like you did DeFi harvesting or some shit is not proof of anything. I can make a YouTube video prove that I did anything I say I did. I can make a YouTube video prove that I can walk across my fucking swimming pool like Jesus. It doesn't mean that it's real. A lot of these people are scam artists. And then there's another piece of this. You have to be really careful when it comes to the advice of wise men with investing. My old mentor, Frank Madron, who was a North Carolina redneck with a Harvard MBA, who built multi-million dollar companies. So yes, this was a wise man. When I first started working for him as a regional salesperson, and I was hitting home run after home run after home run, during the technology boom leading up to the dot-com boom and the dot-com eventual crash, he used to say to me all the time to keep me grounded, Jack, remember that even a turkey can fly in a tornado. Right now, times are good. You have a good product. You're a decent salesperson. You can get in the door. If you get in 10 doors a week, you're going to close 5 deals a week. It's that simple. But if you're not primed for when things change, because they will, when the tornado goes away, you'll be a turkey that can't fly. It is the same concept here that money will cling to the cautious man who only does things with it when under the advice of the wise or their own experience has gotten them to the point where they are wise. Bitcoin flees the man who would force it to impossible earnings. The last one was shitcoin, and then the next one is shitcoin DeFi, right? Like, well, what is the yield? Don't you ever hear that about Bitcoin? What is the yield on Bitcoin? Well, I don't know. If I have an asset that goes up 125% in an annuum, right, and consistently does that, like it has bigger years and smaller years, but when we average it over 10 years, we're making 100, you know, even 50% a year compounded annually over 10 years. And you ask me what the yield is, you know who I know I'm not talking to? I'm not talking to somebody that's giving me the advice of the wise. I'm talking to an idiot. What business throws out a yield to an investor at 50%, let alone 100% of their investment per annum? It doesn't exist. And if it does, sooner or later, it will collapse. Imagine somebody comes to you and says, I want to invest in your business. And you say, okay, great. And your business is profitable. And you actually can do something with the capital. And you say, well, what do you want? You say, well, I'll give you $100,000 to grow your business. And you go, well, okay, I can actually see where incurring that kind of an investment and having an investor makes sense. What do you want back? How much of my company? And they say, not so much do I want a portion of the stock value of your company or shares in your company. I want an investment yield. You say, so basically you're talking about venture debt. And they say, yeah. Okay. Well, how much do you want? Well, I want to put $100,000 in and I want $50,000 back this year and I want $50,000 back next year and I want $50,000 back the next year and I want $50,000 back the next year. And anytime I add more money and I want 50% of it back per annum in perpetuity. You'd say, you're an idiot. Get away from me. I don't know how you got your money, but I don't want anything to do with you. You're too stupid to talk to anymore. Go away. Okay, so when somebody says that an asset with a compounded annual rate of return in the neighborhood of 100% doesn't have a yield, you're talking to an idiot. What they want is spendable cash out of it. And it may be somebody that's accustomed to doing that with something like real estate. And with real estate, that model makes sense. But real estate can't keep up with Bitcoin. The reason you invest in real estate is I have to buy Bitcoin with my money, and I can buy real estate with your money. They're just different things. They're different forms, and they have different burdens. What's my burden to keep Bitcoin? Nothing. I don't pay any tax unless I sell it or spend it. I don't pay anything to maintain it. It's just mine. With a house, I have a roof that I have to replace every 15 years. I got siding. I got foundation issues. I got toilets to fix. If I have a tenant, I have somebody I have to collect money from. There's a significant burden to real estate. It makes sense for most people because you need a place to live, so you might as well own your own house. But in the end, being a landlord has trade-offs. They're valuable and useful trade-offs, but it's not for everybody for sure. And we got one more. Bitcoin comes gladly and in increasing quantity to any man who will put by not less than one-tenth of his earnings to create an estate for his future. That's where that number of saving 10% really became popular in modern American culture and the West as a whole, was Mr. Clausen's book written back in the 1920s. Save a tenth or a tithe. So that actually comes from the root of the Bible. If giving 10% to the poor made sense, then giving 10% to yourself made sense. And then, of course, we make that money that we save, that 10%, that money becomes a slave, and we want that slave to produce more slaves. We want to breed our own slaves. Now, I know that may trigger some people. It's money we're talking about, not people. It's a way to understand it. We're basically turning our dollars or our Bitcoin Satoshis into employees, but employees that we don't have to feed, employees that we don't have to provide health care for. That's the mindset. The value of Bitcoin will go up by doing nothing other than saving it. It's a mathematical certainty at this point. Now, does that mean that Bitcoin will be worth money in 1,000 years? The truth is, I don't know, and people that talk that way, they don't know either. They're saying by preponderance of the evidence, if we don't blow ourselves up, it probably will. Will it? I don't know. A lot of shit can happen in 1,000 years. A lot of shit can happen in 1,000 years. The Star Trek future is, what, 250, 300 years away to the original series? Like 200 years away to the original series, I think. Right? We're not that far away from the Cochrane moment where we get the warp speed. That shit ain't going to happen. But let's say 1,000 years, we can get into the realm of like the next generation Star Trek shit, TNG, right? Where we have replicators, infinite energy, warp speed capability. Would Bitcoin be valuable at that point? Maybe, but I don't know. And would it be more valuable is the bigger thing. If I can literally push a button and make a house, then the value of money goes down because the cost of creating a commodity goes. So, but that's fiction. It's a possible future. But for your future, that's not a thing. And I don't care if you're 15 years old listening to the show because you're smart as a kid. It's not in your future either. None of that shit's happening in our lifetime, so it's irrelevant. All right. The last thing I want to say about this before we go on is something I say all the time. I want to put it just another way, though. And that is every person who's resisted Bitcoin is poor for doing so. There isn't a single person that if you had not begun saving your reserves in Bitcoin earlier, you wouldn't be better off today. There is no time in history you could have started doing that. Now, if you're someone that picked an all-time high to cash out your fully paid home into a second mortgage and lump summed into it, right now that could be painful. If you did that when it was 105, on the day it hit 105, you put it all in there, it could hurt right now. Like I said, Bitcoin's all pain. But if you would do, like, we don't generally make that kind of money in that kind of lump sum in our daily lives. If you were kicking 3, 5, 6%, 10%, 15% of your income in over time, there's no time you lost. I actually did some research, and it was somewhere in 2017 or 2018, that if you went all in with a lump sum investment was the worst day to buy measured in a 5-year period. And you'd still be well off right now, but 5 years later, you'd have been in the hole a little bit. If you would have figured out what the DCA on that lump sum was and did it just monthly, let alone daily, then your return was something like 167%, even if you started on the worst specific day possible. And that was right before the last big run up when we got into the 60K range, when Michael Saylor entered the building, et cetera. So then you were, I mean, you just exploded. It was something like, if you kept doing it till today, starting at the worst time for a 5-year period, when I did that math, it was something like 4,227% was your ROI. So yes, every single person who's resisted Bitcoin is poor for doing so. Period. The end. Infinity. And everybody that continues to do it will. Period. The end. Infinity. With that, let's go ahead and remind you about how you can help the show, and then I'll do some questions. I'm not going to skip them. I do have quite a few questions I starred, but I want to go ahead and tell you about the item of the day today. It's the AeroPress coffee press. This thing is awesome. I've got one right here in my hand. When I close the screen a second, I'll tell you a few things about it. You guys, this is one of those things, like, I've told you about Bitcoin, you didn't listen to me, some of you, and a lot of you told me about the AeroPress, and I didn't listen to you, and we were both wrong. I should have listened to y'all about this a lot quicker than I did. I finally broke down and bought one. I made my wife a cup of coffee with it before for myself, because I always put my wife first. She took one sip of it and said, do that from now on. Like, I'm not, if she sees me with a French press, what are you doing? Why are you touching that now? She wants it from the AeroPress just because the coffee's so damn good. I think part of the reason for it is you use a much finer grind. You do not want to use a super fine grind in a French press because you get a bunch of shit coming through the filter and you end up with all these grinds in your coffee. The AeroPress uses a very, very fine filter. And there's almost no, like, when you look at the bottom of a cup made in the AeroPress, there's no sludge. There's nothing in the bottom of it at all, as long as you do it the right way. So you're using that finer grind. It's also then pressing with air pressure. That's why it's called AeroPress, through the filter mat of the coffee. But the big thing, so Nicole Sauce, who knows a little bit about coffee, right, owner of Hollow Roast Coffee, has like an $800 coffee maker. She ain't going to stop using it. It makes espressos and everything. By the way, you can basically do shit like that with it's a simple little $40 AeroPress you can do it with too. But I made her coffee with it, and 5 minutes later, she's on Amazon seeing how much they cost. And she made her own, and she didn't see me make the first one, and she was still in and out on it. Then I said, let me show you how you do this, and I showed her how to clean it. And when I showed her how to clean it, basically this little piece at the bottom, you put a filter in it, and then that locks onto the bottom of the press. And when you do that, basically that's your reservoir right there. You put coffee in here, you put water in here, and this sits on top of a cup. And I won't get into all of the steps to it, but eventually you take the plunger and put it back in. That's supposedly a giant hypodermic needle. So when you first pour the water in, it will drip through the filter like a pour over. But once you stick your plunger in the top, it forms a seal like a hypodermic syringe, and it stops coming out. You give it a little bit of time, and then you push it down slowly, and you push the coffee through the filter, and it makes a puck that looks just like the puck that comes out of an espresso machine when you empty it. Well, you turn it over, and you open it. You pull this thing off, and the puck and the filter sticks to the plunger. And you take that and you put it over your, you know, wherever you're going to catch your waste, and you pop it like that. The whole thing comes off. There'll just be a little tiny bit of coffee on the plunger bottom at that point. You rinse this off with water from the sink. It takes about an ounce of water to clean it. And when you pull this back through, it doesn't mess up the inside because all the coffee came off and it was all pushed through because it's a perfect seal. You rinse this piece. And you're done. You've cleaned it. I mean, literally, it's faster to clean than I just described it. That alone, plus a superior product. And there's a bunch of things you can do with it. You can make, basically, using less water, an espresso shot. You can take that espresso shot and add hot water to it, make a cafe Americano. You can froth your own milk and make a latte. You can do whatever you want to with it. We just make badass coffee with it. I'll give you my secret, especially for those of you who are using it already. The way they tell you to use it, there's these little increments on it, and I believe they're ounces. It's 1, 2, 3, and 4. And if you're making just a cup of coffee, it says fill it to the 4, mix it for 10 seconds, put the plunger in, wait 30 seconds, push it down, and then clean it the way I said. You get 4 ounces of coffee that way. You see this, you know, rainbow farting unicorn cup of mine? Does it look 4 ounces? No. So what I did is I increased the amount of coffee by a third. I fill it to the absolute top. I let it drain down to the floor. I fill it again. That makes 6 ounces per load. When it gets back near the floor, I put the plunger in, wait 30 seconds, and push it down. I get basically a full cup of coffee by doing it that way. So you can do whatever you want. There's inverted method. There's a ton of shit. It's a whole rabbit hole to go down and figure out how to make your coffee even better. And there's a lot of variables you can play with, the grind size, et cetera. And the Vavore burr grinder is what I recommend you pick up if you don't have a burr grinder yet. Anyway, let's go ahead and take some questions here. I got 6 starred questions. We'll see if they're even about Bitcoin. I know there's going to be one in here like how to start a worm farm or something. Andrew says, do you recommend 5 to 10% of your wealth in Bitcoin like you do gold or silver, or am I looking at it wrong? That would be a good start. This is what I'm going to tell you. If you start stacking Bitcoin with any meaningful effort, you'll get to a point where it's 5 to 10% of your net worth. And if you keep doing it, eventually it will exceed it. I want as high a percentage of net worth, of my own net worth in Bitcoin as possible, assuming the rest of my life is going well. Assuming that doesn't mean that, you know, I have to hitchhike wherever I go because I can't afford a car and my house has a hole in the roof. So I don't really want to think of it as a limitation, but I would say what percentage of your capital is maybe a better way to look at Bitcoin. When I say 5% of your net worth in precious metal, I'm including the equity in your home as part of your net worth. When I look at your home, though, your home is an appreciating asset. It will go up in value over time, too. You'll only realize that if you do something to monetize it, like sell the house, rent the house, you know, or something like that, or take a loan out of the underlying value and use it for tax-free cash flow. I'm not advising any. I'm just saying it's the only way you'll realize the gain in the value of the property, but there is a gain there. Bitcoin is a liquid asset, unlike a house. A house is not a liquid asset. The amount of the value of your house that truly is as liquid as possible, meaning if I put it up for sale for this much, somebody will buy it today, is much lower than the true value of it. That's like a fire sale on property. Even in that instance, there's a time to close. Not only is Bitcoin liquid is that it can be converted to cash in minutes by using an exchange. It also can be transferred from one person to another. So it's money. It's not just an asset. It's an asset that is a monetary asset. So if Weathered Soul, who has the next question here, wants something from me, he wants value from me, Bitcoin is liquid in that if we agree that $10,000 is how much he wants for whatever he's selling, that in 10 minutes he can have $10,000 worth of Bitcoin or X number of sats or X, you know, 0.1 Bitcoin or whatever it is. Speaking of that, let's go on to Weathered Soul. Will there be a Bitcoin economy that lives parallel to fiat, meaning will Bitcoin and fiat ever become uncoupled? I don't know the answer to that. The Uber Bitcoin maxis that make up all kinds of shit like we diffused today would tell you they cannot coexist. If you look at somebody like Michael Saylor, he's going to tell you they are going to coexist. And I'm going to tell you they can. It doesn't mean that they will. We could get to a point where so much distrust occurs in the economic world that people literally decouple from fiat. And the entirety of the world's currency is 21 quadrillion Satoshis. And they would probably at that point have a value somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 cents a piece. 50 cents a piece. If you want to do the math on that, $1 million Bitcoin is 1 penny Satoshis. Right? So a dime per sat is $10 million, right, per Bitcoin. So 50 cent Satoshis is $100 million of Bitcoin. There's people that in their head, that's how rich they're going to be. Even if it happens, I honest to God, for people that are middle-aged and older, don't see it happening while you're here, even in the best case scenario. But they certainly can coexist, and one certainly can destroy the other. That's true. I see no way for fiat to destroy Bitcoin. I definitely see ways Bitcoin could destroy fiat. But one of the legacy things that makes fiat likely to be around a very long time is it has an embedded base, and it's very hard to unlodge an embedded base. It takes a long time. For instance, every piece of accounting software on the planet runs on fiat. People like cheap debt. One thing you do not have with a deflationary currency is cheap debt. You have expensive debt, and therefore debt is something people are less likely to go into. Think about buying a car or a house in that scenario. You have to save your wealth and then be willing to part with it. But there's another side to that, right? It leads to a far more efficient economy. Now, the only thing Ford is thinking, or any car manufacturer is thinking when they build the next car, is how much money can we make and how little can we make it cost the customer per month? That's it. So, you know, they have money. So it's like, well, you know, financing a car at 5 years doesn't work anymore. We'll just do 6 or 7. There's people that are doing 84-month financing on a fucking car right now. There's people that are financing cars that are already 2 or 3 years old at 72 months. That's 6 years. It's idiotic, but they're doing it. Where if that wasn't an option, right? I mean, the guy that really did it ended up with Chrysler, but he did it at Ford. Was Lee Iacocca. He called it the 50-50 plan. That a whole group of cars on the lot, different makes, models, etc. 50 months, $50, pick one and drive it home today. $50 down, $50 a month for 50 months. Pick your car. Sounds great. Hey, it was a lot more money than you think it was at the time. And it started in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That was the first car payment plan like that. It was revolutionary. Before that, what the manufacturer had to do was think, how can we lean out the cost of this product so much that the product is affordable and we still make a profit? So that would be that's the push-pull against it. Liberty Cast says, any recommendation on pro-crypto traditional bank or fintech firm? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is how I feel about your regular everyday bank. Don't even talk to them about Bitcoin, and I don't want to use the word crypto at all. Crypto is a garbage word. It's been destroyed by crypto bros and shitcoiners. There's Bitcoin and there's crypto. Technically, Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency. I get it, but we shouldn't even use the word crypto. You should just get that out of your mouth. Don't say it. Go right now, Liberty Cast. Go to your bathroom and bite a bar of Dial or Lifeboy or some shit. You've sinned by saying crypto in that context. It is better that your bank not know. Now, I do think we're starting to see Bitcoin-centric financial institutions that may eventually replace banks. Like, I need to set up an account with River from what you guys have told me. That's just another one of those things I got to do that I ain't got to yet. But in general, like, it is very convenient. We pay all our bills with our bank account. It is. It really is. There's a utility to that, and it works. And they don't need to know about Bitcoin, and I don't need to worry about Bitcoin in my bank. However, you're going to see it. You're going to see that change. It won't just be firms like River. Like the new executive order Trump did allows banks to custody crypto, which means if they can custody crypto, they can custody Bitcoin. And I think the loans we were talking about with Bitcoin will come probably in the next year or two. We will get to a point where you can tender Bitcoin as collateral on a loan, collateralize some percentage of the loan, and as you pay down the loan, you decollateralize the reserved Bitcoin. The bank being able to custody that is what makes it possible. Right now, banks have not been able to custody Bitcoin. We're still dealing with the fallout from Operation Choke Point, which was designed to cause the problem Liberty Cash is trying to avoid. It's pretty much gone now. Chokepoint is dead, but its legacy remains. There's banks that still have these stupid internal policies and nobody even really understands it. That's why your bank tells you shit like, we can't tell you why we closed your account. Because they don't even, the person you're talking to doesn't even know why. That's why they tell you that. They just, that's what they're told to say. But I would look, if you want to start banking and making Bitcoin part of it, I mean, you can do that with Strike right now. You can do that with River right now. I'm going to bet you Fold is going, now that Fold went public, they're going to become that. Those who don't know, Fold went public, and I think they're the first Bitcoin-only company to make that move. Next up, Liberty Garden. Is the U.S. trying to use gold to rebase the U.S. dollar, then offer transparency to the reserves through a blockchain? I doubt it. And I will say this. If somehow we return to a gold standard with the amount of gold that we have, you're going to wish you listened to Peter Schiff, right? I mean, what are you going to have to value gold at to make that worth? Every $1,000 is backed by an ounce. Maybe you can make that work. The only way the U.S. could make a move like that, they would have to start very quietly, if it's even possible, on a global commodity like this, stacking the ever-loving fuck out of gold. Like, the other thing that could happen, this is not going to happen, but it, in theory it could. You go down and audit the Fort Knox gold reserves, and there's 100 times more gold in there than we said there was. Then maybe you could make that work. I think that it is actually possible, long-term, that countries could go to a Bitcoin reserve in a hybrid fiat hard scenario like we used to have with gold. Like a portion. I mean, you have to think of, there's a traditional way that's worked out in having like a partial backing. So, for instance, you know, you had empires that, you know, their primary coin, let's say, was a 1/10 ounce silver coin, and it was 95% silver, with a little bit of something else in there to make it more of something that could be durable when it went, was exchanged, right? And so then it got reduced to 90% silver, but the face value stayed the same. That's where silver currency was in the United States, 1964 and back. But there were empires where, well, you know, they brought all the money in and put the new emperor's face on it. And when it went back out, it was 85%. So they stole 5% of the value of people's money. Bring your money in, we'll remint it. And people obeyed and did it, and they reminted it. And that was direct inflation against the hard money, and just changed the backing. And they could do that every so often and get away with it. And eventually it got to a point where nobody wanted it anymore because it had too little of the hard money in it, and it had to be completely reset. We could see something like that happen with Bitcoin. We could see something like happen with Bitcoin and gold, where the government says it's not so much you can exchange it for, but the United States government will maintain a peg of, you know, 1/10. Something like that could happen, but I don't see it anytime soon. But gradually, then suddenly, builder of castles, how will you feel when these words are used back at you? Super duper Bitcoin comes out in 20 years, a paradigm shift of money again. I'm going to ignore that. It's bullshit. I don't care. Nothing you said made any sense to me at all. I think you're saying like Bitcoin is the past and Ripple is the future, basically. If there is need to upgrade Bitcoin itself, Bitcoin Core, we can do that through consensus. Consensus is what has the anchor, and the anchor is what gives it viability long term. I'm going to read another same person, so it might be a restatement. Comment on your future when in the future your great-grandson finally, with much work, scrapes together their first full Satoshi, a celebration moment if there ever was. Okay, that's interesting. It's a different way of looking at it. So what he's saying then is, you know, in the future, earning your first sat might be earning your first dollar. That's a great future, but I won't see it. And if I do, great. And I will not plan on it. I don't bet on it. A couple more questions. Texas Plant Company, any thought on Mar-a-Lago Accord, a monetary system changes in the next few weeks? Now, our monetary system will not. I don't even know what that is, and I don't know what Trump's doing with Bitcoin reserves and all, but we will not have our monetary system change in the next few weeks or few months or few years, 100% monetary shift. That is not going to happen. There is too much of an entrenched base there. He also asked, same guy said, if you have to relocate, would you buy or rent right now and put excess into Bitcoin? I can't answer that because I don't know. Why do I have to? How much money do I have? Where am I going? How much does that house cost? I mean, if I relocate right now, I'm doing some, the only way it's going to happen is I'm doing it because I'm motivated by some serious geographic arbitrage. So my house, I owe very little on it at this point relative to its value. If I sold this house in the next month or two for what I can get without really trying really hard, like just throw it out there, it's going to sell. I can walk away with about $300,000, $350,000, no problem. Probably more. That's sandbagging to the low. If I'm moving somewhere and I can go and I can buy what I want for $200,000, I'm buying that house and paying it off. I'll put the rest of it to work somewhere else. If I'm moving because I lost everything, my house is foreclosed on, I'm probably renting because I don't have a fucking choice. Because I probably can't buy something. So I can't answer that question because the way it's asked, it's one of those questions like, remember when you used to take standardized tests back in school and sometimes one of the answers would be there's insufficient information in the question to answer it accurately? That's what that is. And there is no way that you can create sufficient information because it's all hypothetical anyway. Right. You could give me a hypothetical. I'd say, well, in that hypothetical, then I would do this. Right. But it doesn't mean anything because it's not going to match anybody else's actual situation. There are people that just do not want to buy property and there are people that just do not want to rent property. And that's personal. And neither one of them are wrong positions. Now, when you look at the person's financial health, like if they were a financial report card, they may be doing a stupid fucking thing based on their financial health, but the overriding preference is not the problem there. It's that you have not adapted your preference to reality. Me, I like owning property. I like harvesting equity. A lot of the wealth I've built in my life has to do with I bought my first house in my early 20s, and I've owned quite a few houses, and I've sold quite a few houses. I've owned houses for myself. I've owned houses as rentals. And it's never not benefited me. Now, if I took all the money that I put into housing, assuming it was even possible because I had to live somewhere, since 2010 into Bitcoin, would I be ahead? Yes. Yes. But was Bitcoin the good bet that it was, that it is today in 2010? No. That's what people understand. When people tell you, well, it's almost $100,000 now. It's risky. No, it was risky when it was 10 bucks. You're going to buy the same amount, right? Your investment's 1,000 bucks. It's 1,000 bucks no matter the price. The security of the investment is based on the security of the asset long term. It's okay, we have it in pension funds. It's in an ETF. Choke point's dead, right? We have the President of the United States talking about a strategic Bitcoin reserve. We have nation states that already have Bitcoin reserves. We have companies that are following the Saylor playbook of selling their own stock or issuing debt to use other people's money to buy Bitcoin. We have hedge funds that use Bitcoin. We have futures on Bitcoin. Like, it's more safe as an investment today than it's ever been, and people are more scared of it than ever because of sour grapes. When people say I missed the opportunity, they don't even fucking mean it. It is a visceral response because I'm mad that I didn't do it. And the only person you hurt by taking that approach, honest to God, folks, is yourself. Well, anyway, I appreciate y'all tuning in today. Went longer than I planned because we had a lot of questions, which is a good thing. I will catch you guys tomorrow. Tomorrow we're bringing on an expert council member, and we're going to be talking about knives and blades. So I guess you know who that will be. Patrick Rorman will be on tomorrow. Then we'll have an expert council show on Thursday. Friday we'll have a Friday flashback. And next week, we'll do it all over again. Take care, guys. And real quick, if you want to come meet me and hang out, you got two opportunities coming up. One in, it's like the third weekend of March. I'm going to be about an hour north of my place at a place called Crunchy Mama Farms for a beef processing workshop. There'll be links in today's show notes to that for you. And I think Nicole Sauce has a few seats left for her workshop in April at Living Free in Tennessee. And I will be there and I will be doing hands-on instruction of making biochar and building bioreactor composters. Okay, so I'll be at both of those. And either one, you come hang out with me and some other really cool people. With that, take care. I'll catch you guys next time around. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.